Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello everyone, this is Fabrice. I'm going to talk to you about a woman who was a member of the infamous 27 Club, those rock icons who tragically passed away at age 27. With her raspy and soulful voice, her intonations that reflected her authenticity and pain, she is one of the symbols of the hippie and beatnik counterculture of the 60s. Her name, Janis Joplin. Behind her shattered destiny, discover her tragic story. Who wouldn't recognize her distinctive voice? Janis Joplin, with her exceptional voice capable of interpreting the saddest blues, the most rebellious rock, and the gentlest ballads, undoubtedly moved everyone lucky enough to see her in concert. If Janis had such intensity on stage, it's undoubtedly because she always sought it, starting from her teenage years. Born on January 19, 1943 in Port Arthur, Texas, she came from a small, conformist, and even reactionary bourgeois environment, far from her aspirations. She craved freedom and openness to the world. Her escape was music, which she embraced from a young age. She loved the blues of Bessie Smith and sang in the local choir, imitating her beloved black idol. She identified with African-American music and quickly opposed racial segregation. She admired Bessie Smith's freedom and refused to restrict herself because she was a woman. Her rebellious personality threw people off and provoked mockery from her classmates, especially in college. One day, some boys from a fraternity decided to elect the ugliest boys on campus, and Janis won. All the sadness of her short existence and her desire for revenge are encapsulated in this seemingly ordinary, yet undeniably harsh story. So, as soon as she could, at the age of 17, she left Port Arthur for Beaumont, Venice, and then Austin, where she continued to face scrutiny. She sang in bars, spoke and laughed loudly. She was too liberated for her time, especially because she openly embraced bisexuality. Still facing criticism, she decided to leave and try her luck in San Francisco. There, she frequented the haunts of the beatnik scene, with all that it entailed, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. At that time, a band was emerging on the West Coast and was in need of a singer. That band was Big Brother and the Holding Company. Chet Helms, their manager, spotted Janis at the Coffee Gallery in the North Beach neighborhood of San Francisco. Her voice surpassed all others, and he decided to hire her as the lead singer. Janis and the band now lived together in a hippie squat, where other important figures of the time, such as Jefferson Airplane, gathered. From her first appearance with Big Brother and the Holding Company on June 12, 1966 at the ballroom, the audience was captivated. It was in the summer of 1966 that she hit the road with her group of long-haired, blues-inspired musicians. But her true breakthrough came in June 1967.
Three or four years ago, on one of my perennial hitchhikes across the country, I ran into a chick in Texas by the name of Janis Joplin.
On June 17, 1967, when Janis Joplin took the stage at the Monterey Pop Festival in California in front of over 70,000 people, alongside performers like Brian Jones and Jimi Hendrix, no one knew her. In the mid-afternoon, a 24-year-old woman dressed modestly in beige with a rather unconventional appearance stepped onto the stage. But the way she began singing the blues with erotic and raspy undertones set the stage on fire. Possessed in her performance, she completely mesmerized a crowd who clung to her singing, sometimes with open mouths. The most mesmerizing moment was when she sang Ball and Chain with all her soul and guts, her eyes half closed, her voice husky and her feet tapping. She knew that the joy she experienced on stage was contagious because the crowd cheered her on. Janis was the revelation of the festival and caught the attention of the famous manager Albert Grossman, who took the group under his wing the following year. Before we continue with this episode, a quick break to give the floor to our partner, without whom this podcast could not exist. Don't go away, we'll be right back. From there, her career took off immediately. Her rendition of Summertime set sales records, with over a million copies sold in a month, making Janis one of the biggest stars of the late 1960s music scene. But while fame and money were there, so was weariness. In September 1968, Janis Joplin decided to part ways with her musicians. She changed bands, achieved success with songs like Work Me Lord, a triumph, but caused the downfall of the new band due to the preference for Janis over other members. Musicians came and went, but Janis kept on going, constantly on the move. With this lifestyle, she became increasingly dependent on heroin, which isolated her from the real world. Until Woodstock. At 2:30 a.m. on Sunday, August 17, 1969, Janis Joplin began her first notes with her raspy voice on the festival stage. In the hours leading up to her performance, she became increasingly nervous as she saw the dance crowd. Originally scheduled to perform around 9 p.m., her set was pushed back. Janis spent her time backstage by drinking champagne, whiskey, and using heroin. The audience welcomed her with their usual trance, and Janis exploded on stage, unrestrained. However, it wasn't Janis Joplin's best performance, as she was visibly intoxicated. Her manager, Albert Grossman, opposed her performance being included in the film dedicated to the festival. The singer will later admit that she preferred intimate venues to large festivals, but regardless, Woodstock felt like her swan song. From then on, all her stage performances exuded a sense of discomfort. On August 12, 1970, Janis Joplin performed for the last time at the Harvard Stadium in Boston, and it was a disaster. Wobbly and drunk, she could only manage to sing two songs. Despite this, she still entered the studio to record her new album and attempted to stay clean. On October 1, 1970, she recorded her final song, Mercedes-Benz and Birthday Wishes, intending for John Lennon, who only received the tape after the singer's death. 2 days later, she visited Sunset Sound Recorder Studios in Los Angeles to listen to the instrumental track for the song Buried Alive in the Blues, which she was scheduled to record the following day. She had a drink and returned to her hotel in Hollywood. On the morning of October 4th, The studio team awaited her, but she was running late. Her manager at the time, John Cook, concerned by her absence, knocked on the hotel room door. Silence, a troubling silence. He had the door opened and found her lifeless at the foot of her bed. The singer had passed away around 1:40 a.m. due to a heroin and alcohol overdose. Her solo album, Pearl, a brilliant display of raw emotions and heart-wrenching melodies, was only released posthumously and became her greatest success. Cry Baby and Mercedes-Benz are anthems that have outlived her, like the cry of a generation. Janis Joplin, a woman of fiery temperament and assertive feminism, still continues to captivate us today, more than 50 years after her passing. Thank you for listening to this episode of Fabulous Destinies. Feel free to share with us stories that you would like to hear on your favorite listening platform or via Baba Bam's Instagram or Twitter page. We'll be happy to discover them.